Celebration 25. 25 years of making new friends, of holding hands with Southern California. News, information, and entertainment. Join Celebration 25 with
Phil Jenkins.
And welcome in to our Saturday night. For the next 3 hours, it's open mind, and I am so delighted you're along. And I believe tonight may be one of those special nights where you want to call a friend and get your tape recorders going. Because it's a night we're going to dedicate to something extremely serious that just very well may be a part of the reality that we are having to live with these days. The reality of the weather war. In the spring of 1983, it stopped raining in the Midwest. The United States lost about half of its all-important corn crop. In April of 1984, a column of water 150 miles wide, rose out of the Sea of Japan, 200 miles off Tokyo, south of the Kuril Islands, to an altitude of 60,000 feet in 2 minutes. Five Boeing 747s headed for Tokyo took evasive maneuvers, expecting to be hit by a shock wave caused by what they saw as a massive mushroom cloud suddenly appearing in front of them. There was no shock wave, no heat blast, no contamination. It was a cold explosion. To the trained observer and aware researcher, that event suddenly brought into focus puzzling ongoing sightings of pulsing plumes of smoke off Bennett's Island and Novaya Zelma to the west of Bennett's Island on the Soviet Arctic coast. December 1984, off the Southern California coast, the area was rocked for weeks by strange booms or explosions, window-rattling shocks which could not be explained. Within 48 hours after the boom stopped, Los Angeles was ripped by a violent killer windstorm, which then moved across Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, and up the Adirondack chain. Now, in the wake of that weather incident, there was a record flooding, gripping ice storms, rain, and cold, which broke all known records. The East Coast plunged into a sub-zero deep freeze, which lasted for weeks, brought business and commerce to a near standstill. Also, nearly 500 Americans were killed in weather-related deaths. Mother Nature on a rampage? Or could these events be related? Well, for some dedicated men of science, these events and others are pieces of a giant puzzle. And with an open mind, they are putting that puzzle together. And I am very glad to have with us tonight one of those men that is putting those pieces of puzzle together. He's a good friend of mine, a good friend of yours. He is very concerned about this problem, and we want to deal with it now. The weather war. Mr. Thomas Bearden. Tom, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Bill. It's nice to be back.
It's always good to have you. Is there an undeclared war going on between two superpowers, Tom, and one of them doesn't even know they're being attacked?
Well, I think there is, Bill. It's certainly my opinion that that's exactly the case. I think that for a period of some years, the Soviet Union has been using the new technology that it's developed based on Nikola Tesla's discoveries to manipulate the weather over North America. And I believe there's enough evidence for that to cause any open-minded researcher very serious concern indeed. Now, for example, the science that is emerging that's used for this, we'll take a small digression to cover just a bit of that. In fact, I want to take a little bit of an unusual digression from what I normally say in this fashion. I want to tell you first about some serious flaws that exist in the science we presently have in the West that allowed us to miss this particular thing that's used in the weather war. The first one is in, strangely enough, the very science that, mathematics that permeates most of our science called vector analysis. There's one of the assumptions at the heart of vector analysis, one of the axioms, that establishes what we call a zero vector. It makes all of them identical and makes all of them equal to zero. And it's standard practice in physics that when you have a vector or a sum of vectors, these particular entities that represent moving things, dynamic things, When you have a series of those that sum to zero, you simply throw away the series. It's based on that axiom. Well, as a matter of fact, modern physics itself says that at base root there's nothing static, everything's dynamic, and that the vectors themselves are established and kept there by dynamic processes. That's the way quantum mechanics views the situation. So really, when we have such a system, we should keep the vectors there as still being present and hidden inside the zero. So one of the problems facing us is the fact that an axiom of the very mathematics we use contains a glitch, so to speak, that causes us to miss some of the things that happen. Okay, I'll pass through this very quickly, and I hope our listeners will bear with me for just a moment. We then pass to general relativity. When Einstein formed general relativity, at that time, which was well before World War II, way back there, we're talking back, you know, back 1918, along in there, when the heavy work was going on at the initiation of general relativity, really 12, 13, so forth. At that time, the only way they knew to bend and curve space-time, which is what general relativity deals with, was when you had a huge collection of mass, something like a sun, or something like a giant star, or a neutron star, or a Clampling star. Certainly, where we would be with our instruments on the Earth, or out in space, or whatever, measuring, no one knew any way to cause any serious curving or bending of space-time. In other words, we call that the local region. That's where the observer is, and that's where the instrument is that we're doing our measurements with. And so Einstein himself put in the assumption that you really wouldn't have general relativity where you yourself were and where the instrument was. Now, let me make this very clear. This is a standard assumption taught in all the universities throughout the land that in the local system where we're measuring and where we're doing our detecting, we do not have general relativity at all. And yet it's called general relativity. The general relativity occurs way out yonder somewhere, but it doesn't bother us where we are. We are very calm, cool, and collected. None of those effects of where we are. The reason that he did that was so that he could save the conservation laws. And all you energy buffs, perk up your ears, please. If you do not make that assumption, for example, suppose we really knew how to curve the space-time appreciably where we were. If we could do that, then all of the conservation laws go out the window. That is, the conservation of energy, conservation of mass and momentum and so forth, and even the conservation of charge. I want to repeat that so that everybody understands what I'm saying. We already know in general relativity, ordinary physics, that if we could bend the space-time locally, all of our conservation laws would go out the window. Now, that would be a very strange world indeed, because everything that seems stable and steady and permanent in our world and gives us a feeling of personal security that reality is going to continue to march on just like it always has, all of that would be changeable. It would be up for grabs and engineerable. And so, since nobody knew how to do that, Einstein put in the assumption that that would not happen. And so, the world remained safe and sane where the observer and the instruments are, and all the crazy stuff happens out there in the stars or in the black hole or someplace way out there from us. Now, I want to reiterate that I pointed out an effect here that if we could get it in our instruments or make devices that would do that, we would have devices which would do some very unusual things indeed. And that's already in the orthodox science, but assumed away because we simply said we don't know how to do it. We don't see any way to do it, and so therefore it will never be done.
But the truth of the matter seems to be emerging now, Tom, that somebody has figured out how to do it.
That's correct. Nikola Tesla was the first one, as far as I can find out, who found out how to do that. Tesla found out how to make a more fundamental electromagnetic wave. Without saying it in these words, what he did was he found out that if he turned the waves against themselves, locked them together so that they summed to zero, their fields summed to zero, that he could make a more fundamental wave, a more fundamental vibration, that would do extraordinary things. He reported that he could produce energy at a distance or transmit it at a distance without wires and without any losses, or very little losses indeed. He didn't report that he could extract energy from a distance the same way, but he did report that he could build a big eye that could see at a distance, and that would have been the way he would have been doing that.
So we're looking at the science of Nikola Tesla, which has been refined, and perhaps, Tom, is being used against us and what we're looking upon as the weather war.
That's correct.
The subject tonight of Open Mind, my guest is Tom Bearden. I'm Bill Jenkins. Bill Jenkins, it's Open Mind. With me is Tom Bearden, who has electrified us on many occasions, but tonight it's something important. Well, it always is. But it is that we are in the midst, perhaps, of the first battles of the weather war. And the weapon is something you're describing called a scalar wave. Is that not right?
That's correct. Let me explain what a scalar wave is. First of all, it's a gravitational wave. And I'm going to explain real simply how to make it. And then I'll give you a very concrete way of seeing that the energy really is there and you really are making a curvature of space-time or a gravitational wave. Imagine you have a plate in front of you, a steel plate. And you have your fingers pressing on each side of the plate. The two hands are pressing on the plate with the fingers extended so that the fingers are a series of forces pressing on that plate. But there are equal and opposite forces on it, and so the plate is under equal pressure in all directions. In other words, equal set of forces. They all sum to zero. We say they have a zero resultant. That means the plate does not accelerate, doesn't move, doesn't wiggle, doesn't jiggle. It would seem to just be sitting there and doing nothing. But that's a very different plate indeed from one which has no forces at all on it. So that plate is under stress. Now suppose I rhythmically increase the pressure with which I'm pushing and decrease it. I increase it and decrease it in rhythmic fashion. The plate now is being stressed and relieved, and so there is a stress wave in the plate, but the plate still does not wiggle, does not jiggle, does not move, does not accelerate. Now, give us any indication of that, unless something breaks, unless it fractures. And that plate has a stress wave, and it is the medium. Now, if we throw the plate away, and we have the vacuum in front of us, pure space-time, and we have electromagnetic forces acting against each other and locked together, we have exactly the same situation existing in the vacuum. We have stress in the vacuum itself that we've placed in there with this wave that sums to zero. All the fields sum to zero vectors. And now if we rhythmically vary all the components, all the individual little fingers of forces stressing the vacuum, we will increase the stress and decrease it, increase it and decrease it. And so we will produce in the vacuum a stress wave. However, look at it this way. There is no resultant force field being created there at the place where it's stressing it. Yet the energy from every one of those forces, which now are waves, is locked in at that point. And so we have at that point increase in the energy and decrease in the energy that's locked in vacuum. And rigorously, by general relativity, that constitutes a gravitational wave. In other words, a scalar wave, a scalar electromagnetic wave, is really an electrogravitational wave. It is the final solution to the electrogravitics that started with such promise and then died out in the early 60s in the United States and some in Europe. But it is an electrogravitational wave. And what you have done is you have turned electrical energy, electromagnetic energy, directing into gravitational field energy, and vice versa. So with this tool now, you have a new kind of electromagnetic wave, and it bridges the difference between electromagnetism and gravitation. Now, I know that these tapes are played many places, and I know we have many technical people listening to us in the audience. If, bear with me for just a moment. If you will check the Colusa paper that in the 1921 was published upon the recommendation of Albert Einstein, you will find that Colusa, for example, had unified gravitational field theory and electromagnetic field theory. He did this by adding another dimension so that you had a five-dimensional science. Now, don't get worried about dimensions. They're just very fundamental variables. We're talking about how a mathematical model is built here, that's all. But when you did that, you only had one kind of field in this so-called higher universe. And our universe intersects that field in two fashions. It intersects it in one fashion as our normal gravitational field, and the rest of it bleeds out in the fifth dimension there as what we see as electromagnetic field. Now, it turns out that it's a great deal easier for that five-dimensional gravitational field to bleed into electromagnetics. So all you technical people, please sit up and write this down in your textbook or in your little notebook. Anytime you have a circuit or a series of circuits which allows the free travel of ordinary electromagnetic force fields, you have a circuit which continually bleeds off the fundamental five-dimensional gravitational field. And therefore, you're not going to get any bleed-off into the ordinary gravitational field to speak of. You'll get very little gravitational effects, if any. So small, you can't even measure them. On the other hand, if you choke off the throttle, so to speak, you choke off the valve, allowing the bleed off of this field into electromagnetics, and you do that by fighting electromagnetics against itself, making vector zeros. When you shut off the main pipeline, but you still have little pipelines through the shut-off valve so that you can pump this more fundamental field that Colusa talked about, then that pumping has to go into the ordinary gravitational field. In other words, what I've shown you by a little analogy here is that you indeed are turning electromagnetic energy directly into gravitational field energy and vice versa when you make the vector zero. Now, that's enough of the technical stuff. Let's talk about now how to use it.
All right, that is what we really want to get into. We did want to set some technical basis for what we're talking about.
Right.
Because the things that we're going to discuss that seem to be happening, that a great deal of data has been gathered so far, that we can say with some degree of confidence, because of the data that is here, photographs, other things, that we have come to the point where that very well, that science, may be used against us and what we're calling here tonight, the weather war. Behind and with me, Tom Bearden. Tom, very involved in some of the outer limits of scientific research and understanding, and certainly one of the most knowledgeable men around about a new science known as scalar interferometry. And it is that scalar wave now that is creating a lot of problems. A lot of problems emotionally for a lot of scientists on the western side, and problems for us physically, it looks like, Tom.
Yes, that's true, Bill. And it's the technology, unfortunately, has been being developed for quite a while in the Soviet Union. I would call attention real quickly to some of the background for people who haven't heard these presentations before. In 1960, Khrushchev pointed out that the Soviet Union had a new fantastic weapon, very powerful indeed. In fact, remarks were made that it could destroy all life on Earth if it were unrestrainedly used. Part of that, the first part of that is, of course, printed in the New York Times in January of 1916, can be checked. So we know that in 1960 they were in advanced research and development for some kind of very, very powerful new weapon, which seemed to be greater than the rockets and missiles and nukes and everything else. In 1963, we have incidents of the Thresher, mysterious death of the Thresher, its loss, and certain circumstances that happened with it. The day after the death of the Thresher, there was another one of these giant mushrooms of water that rose up a half a mile to 3/4 of a mile or so high in this case, about 100 miles from Puerto Rico. That appears to have been the test of one of these weapons that had gone on-site operational. So it seems that about 1963 or so, the weapons actually went on-site operational in the Soviet Union. There is some tentative evidence, which is probably better than I've had time to look at, because I simply have not had time to go through it. But that 1967, they started a first tentative attempt at doing some weather engineering over the United States. The signatures for that weather engineering was mysterious and anomalous holes that appeared in clouds throughout the U.S. It was noted by the meteorologist. They took pictures, for example, recorded the incidents, and printed them in the journals and technical magazines. They're there for 1967. And, of course, in 67-68, we had a very severe winter, which may have been the result of early-on weather engineering by the Soviet Union. If so, I do not know the nature of the transmitters, have not had time to look in to see if that can be found. So maybe some other researchers would look at 67-68 real good, and those anomalous holes and any possible connection with the weather conditions, freak weather conditions that happened in 67-68. But certainly before the death of Brezhnev, let's say about towards the end of 82, the Soviet Union began to adjust in the interference of gigantic beams over the United States. Now, let me backtrack just a moment. In the mid-70s, the world was shocked by the advent of very powerful transmitters from the Soviet Union in the communications band. Down in the megahertz region there, 3 to 30 megahertz, where the normal communications are chattering away all the time. And they were interfering with communications worldwide. These were called the woodpecker signals because the chirp signal sounded very much like a woodpecker's beak hitting a wooden block. And so in the mid-70s, they did open up very, very powerful transmitters of the normal kind. Now, I'm not particularly interested in the normal electromagnetic force fields that we normally measure on those signals. Now, that's the normal stuff, and everybody out there, all our scientists, has plenty of good instrumentation to measure that to a gnat's eyebrow. I'm interested, however, in the hidden scalar stuff that is riding on those signals. And I can tell you there is some there that a friend of mine named Frank Golden has measured scalar signals connected with the Soviet weather engineering.
So we have powerful transmissions coming into the United States.
That's right. Very powerful indeed. Estimates of the power of those things run up to, oh goodness gracious, 100 megawatts.
Well, that's very, very powerful.
Very powerful transmitters indeed. And they do interfere with communications. Several nations of the world have protested repeatedly to the Soviet Union. It's always been ignored. And they're chattering away out there still most every night with these transmitters. Now,
We have a series of transmitters now that are beginning to, that are, it looks like, are to your contention.
Yes.
Creating a great problem, which we want to get back into, Tom, for just a second. You're listening to Open Mind tonight. My guest is Tom Bearden, and we're talking about the weather war. And our guest, Tom Bearden, says it's underway, and we happen to be on the receiving end of it. Tom, we were getting into the broadcast of woodpecker signals, but more important to you was the scalar stuff that is also being broadcast along with. In what way is that a problem for us?
Okay, if you'll check, for example, if we look at the latest publication for the general public by the DOD, by the Defense Department, called Soviet Military Power, page 45 of that shows the intersection over the United States of the giant beams from the Soviet woodpecker radars. We say that they are, in fact, over-the-horizon ballistic missile detection systems, which indeed they are. They can do that job, too. And again, I'm not particularly interested in that, except, you know, for ballistic missile early warning. They, however, can do much more than that with the scalar components that are placed on them. And our scientists do not have instruments that pick up and detect the scalar modulations on the radar. The scalar signals are not detected. So, if we look at the pattern of the beams, however, we find that they form an intersection directly over the U.S. After all, if you're going to look for U.S. missile launches, that's exactly what you'd want to do. But if you have a nice intersection already over the United States, wouldn't it be nice if you could do something with that, with the scalar stuff? Because now you have a scalar interferometer that intersects over the United States. And indeed you can. For example, if you make two scalar electromagnetic beams and you interfere them, cross them at a distance, in that crossed point, you can do two things real easy. If the potential you're transmitting with is high, in other words, the voltage is high where you're transmitting, energy will emerge in that distant cross point, in that distant zone. It will emerge throughout that zone. But it is not traveling from the transmitter out there as energy in the normal sense. It's just a potential wave. So you put energy in at the transmitters, you get energy out in the zone out there. If you pulse powerful transmitters like that, so the pulses meet out there, what you get is a sudden violent emergence of energy, and you get something like an electromagnetic explosion. That's the things like the high altitude booms that went off the east coast of the U.S. a few years ago. They were just calibrating the use of these kinds of scalar interferometers or howitzers in that mode. The second thing you can do with this kind of scalar interferometer, if you lower the voltage negative, very negative, on the transmitter and transmit in that mode, you do a very strange thing. The energy flow works in reverse. You extract energy now from the distant zone where the beams cross, and the energy that's extracted there emerges back at the transmitters, again, without traveling through space between as normal electromagnetic energy. It just traveled as a potential wave, a curve of space-time. And so then you have to do something with the energy if you extract very much, or it'll burn out your transmitters. If you're going to do that on a pretty large scale, you're going to be extracting lots of energy from various places in the world, and you'll burn out your transmitters unless you dump it somewhere. Well, what you do, you catch the energy and hold it temporarily for just a moment and switch into the transmit mode and transmit it to a preordained dump site where it's just exhausted in the atmosphere. And our weather satellites have taken, since 1973, over 100 photographs of just such exhausts emerging from Bennett Island, the Soviet Union's Bennett Island. For example, one of those exhausts alone is 150 miles long, and it's almost horizontal on the ground. It's about a degree and a half above the horizontal. Now, I submit to you that volcanoes don't do that. They don't blast away almost horizontally for 150 miles. In streams, a stream of stuff coming out in the jet for 150 miles long. Our weather satellites have photographed that. And, for example, in this videotape we've made, we've included that photograph. They have photographed the emergence of explosive pulses, puffs of exhaust, when transmissions are made, the energy arrived explosively. And so Bennett Island is the smoking gun, so to speak, or the evidence for it. It is the evidence of the exhaust site for the weapons I'm talking about, and there are over 100 satellite photos showing just that.
So we have a situation where scalar beams are being crossed over the United States. When they connect with each other, energy is either dumped in that area, which would create a high-pressure zone, or it is extracted from that area, which would create a low-pressure zone.
That's correct.
And that's all of the ingredients you need for a weather war. Jenkins, Open Mind is the name of this program, and you need one to learn some things you certainly should be considering. Our guest is Thomas E. Bearden. Tom, one of the leading theoretical physicists in the nation today. He's been deeply involved in the development of some of our weapon systems. Is out on the outer edge of physics and science. I appreciate him being with us because he is able to put some very complicated technical material in language that we all can understand. I realize this first 50 minutes has been rather complex, and I applaud you, Tom, and how simple you have made it sound. I have some people here listening, and they're understanding what you're saying.
Good. That's the intent.
We have then these new form of electromagnetic waves that are crisscrossing the United States, coming together, forming a grid, and at that point, energy can be dumped into that interference zone or extracted. that can create highs and lows and certainly do other damage. Is this what was used, in your opinion, off the coast of South Africa when we detected huge blasts out there and thought the South Africans had an atomic bomb?
Yes, indeed. For example, as I said, if you are firing in the energy merge mode, if you fire in that mode, pulses, so the pulses meet, you have an explosive eruption of energy at the point where they cross. And when you do that, you'll get an electromagnetic explosion. You'll have energy given off, and it will look very much like a nuclear explosion if you really pulse it real hard with a lot of energy. For example, you'll have the same rise time that you do with the initial pulse of the nuclear explosion. When the energy is absorbed suddenly in the superheated and compressed air layer around it, you will have a sudden absorption of it, so you'll have the pulse drop off. Then as that layer re-emits the energy at a little bit lower temperature, you'll have a second pulse. It'll look very similar to the two pulses you get out of a nuclear explosion. The difference will be that the pulses will be a little bit more gradual in their decay time and won't be quite the same, because in a nuclear explosion you have the heavier material around the bomb, and so you have more matter to absorb the thing. In the emergence of the electromagnetic explosion, you only have the air and so forth around it, and so you'll have a difference in the absorber material that absorbs the first pulse and then re-radiates it as the second pulse, and that'll give you some difference in the two pulses, and that's the distinction. And that's exactly what the Vela saw, by the way. It saw that kind of a double pulse, which had the kind of difference with the pulses from a nuclear explosion that you would expect if it was electromagnetic energy emerging and air being the absorber. So yes, the Vela satellites detected, I believe, an electromagnetic explosion caused by this kind of a weapon as a test.
And that sort of is borne out by some other facts about that blast. Number one, there was no radiation ever detected, and that was the prime purpose of the Vela satellite. So there was a huge dump of energy with no radiation detected. And didn't it happen a couple of weeks later in the infrared spectrum?
Well, some months later, it happened. Another blast was detected by the satellites, and this one was detected in the infrared. So that wouldn't be a nuke at all, because nukes don't go just in the infrared, and not any kind of nuclear explosion we know anything about. So that would rule out nuclear explosions, but it would not rule out the electromagnetic explosion, because depending on the type of wave you interfered, you could rig it so you would get that.
All right. Now, if we have a way of artificially creating a massive high-pressure zone, would you be able to create one high enough or strong enough to bend the jet streams?
Yes, indeed, because one of the anomalous kinds of things that's been going on to divert the jet stream is already reported by the meteorologists. They're very puzzled over the mechanisms they're calling blocking mechanisms. In other words, gigantic highs, high-pressure areas, that don't move along like they normally do in the atmosphere. They just suddenly sit there. And whereas normally in 3 to 7 days or so you can expect those kinds of things to change and the weather change, in the blocking mechanisms that have been evidenced in the last decade or so, you've had anomalous blocking where high-pressure areas arise anomalously and sit there. And they can sit there for, you know, weeks at a time. And when you do this, you can divert the jet streams and everything else, because the stream is just a giant stream of air. And if there's a high-pressure area in its way, it'll divert around the high-pressure area.
Is that what we saw in 1983 when a very, very strange thing happened? The jet streams, which usually course from west to east across the northern part of the United States, suddenly were diverted very gently down to where they turned around Washington and Oregon, went south down into Texas, and then up the Adirondack Chain.
Well, as a matter of fact, in December of 83, it's already recorded by the meteorologist that we had anomalous high-pressure blocking. There was a high-pressure area, I believe, and I don't have my notes here, so I'm going off the top of my head, but I believe there was one off over the Rockies and one over the North Atlantic at that time. And the blocking mechanisms, by the way, is very controversial still with the meteorologists. They simply do not understand what's going on and what's causing it. And a good meteorologist will tell you they don't understand it. Yes, indeed. In December of 83, certainly, we had anomalous high-pressure blocking areas, and we've had them several times before.
Well, what was interesting about that curvature of the jet stream that happened then is that that stopped the warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico from moving up into the midsection of the United States, and we lost half of our corn crop.
Well, that whole year was very anomalous. As I said, beginning before the death of Brezhnev and continuing thereafter, they were adjusting this grid, the scalar components of the grid, by moving the beam slightly and moving the scalar components around. When you do that, you slip, the energy slips out a little bit, pops out, and you get mysterious rumbles and booms and snaps and crackles and pops. You get airquakes, for example. Sometimes you get very anomalous little micro quakes in the earth in a very localized area. And so throughout the United States during that period, we were getting these snaps and crackles and pops almost everywhere. We were getting them down off the coast of Florida and over Alabama, up through the eastern states in the middle of the country and off over California and so forth, and up in the northwest as well. They were reported all over the United States, the anomalous airquakes and microquakes, mostly the airquakes for those. And so, yes, the evidence of adjusting the grid was there. And the United States, we had very severe flooding in the early spring, or the early part of 1983. Then in the summer, we had a very disastrous drought in the corn crop region. I lost half the corn crop.
We're going to have to pause right now, Tom, for just a second, take time out for the news at 10 o'clock. When we get back, we will talk about something closer to home, if we may, that happened just last December. The strange booms off the California coast and what that bred. And it was, could very well have been, just another one of the battles of the weather war. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. Join us tonight. And with us from Huntsville, Alabama, on our phone, our conference line, Mr. Thomas E. Bearden. Thomas distinguished himself over the last many years of being very, very totally involved in developing some of America's defense systems, the ability to conduct maneuvers by computer at any time that you want to. Has worked with the Pentagon and weapons analysis of the Soviet system. And tonight we're getting a story of how the Soviets have started using a new science that is upon us, scalar interferometry. And there's a lot of reason to believe that that is being used to wage an undeclared weather war. And unfortunately, it seems that we don't even know we're being attacked. But sometime, something closer to home, I think we can all remember this. Early in December last year. In fact, Thomas, you were here. We were doing a free energy show at that time. The western coast of the United States was rocked by some of these strange explosions from San Diego all the way up to here, window-rattling rocks. There were no ships conducting maneuvers. There were certainly no high-flying jet planes that were giving us a bunch of sonic booms, and they were stronger than that, and they could not be explained. What was happening, Tom?
Well, apparently they had been adjusting the grid for a little while there, because those things had been going on off and on for about a week down the south of San Diego and so forth. And so it was apparent that they were doing some adjustment of the grid and the signals on the grid in the area there, in the general Los Angeles area, very close to it. Since they'd been doing that for about a week, that's usually about as long as it takes them to make an adjustment, or it seems to be. So while there, I was on another radio talk show on KABC briefly, and I did point out that you could expect probably a drastic change in the weather very shortly. I think I said within 48 hours.
You did.
And, of course, that occurred. Maybe I was just lucky, but that did occur because they had finished adjusting the grid, and so they just simply cranked the thing up. They started working on the jet stream, and you had very anomalous weather suddenly move in.
What we had were some of the strongest windstorms that we had had in Los Angeles. I think some people were killed here because of those windstorms in a related way. And then that weather system really began to work havoc.
What happened? Yes. It moved on south after the anomalous Santa Ana-type winds in the Los Angeles area and surrounding. It moved on south down into Texas, spawned a lot of tornadoes and things like that, and generally did its thing all the way across the country. But it started right there with the adjustment in the grid to divert the jet streams and change the weather right in and around Los Angeles.
Did we have an unusual bend in the jet streams at that time?
Yes, it bent further south than it normally does. And then about a month or so later, they really bent it. After they played around with it a while, they bent it in almost a right angle bend. And it came down the west coast of the United States, something extremely unusual indeed for a giant river of air. Just try to imagine diverting the Mississippi River, for example, and what you'd have to do to dam that thing up or block it so that it would divert aside like that and keep diverting. Something similar to that was happening with the placement of the high-pressure areas and the low-pressure areas in the upper atmosphere over the United States. They bent the jet stream at a right angle so that it flowed south then and came down the west coast of the U.S., bent it again at a right angle so that it now turned and went eastward across the lower end of Texas, Louisiana, and along and through there, and then roared it up the mountain chain across the east, the Adirondacks. And so with that anomalous bend, of course, you had very anomalous weather start to move in. You had cold air spill in from Canada, come much deeper down south than it normally does. So you had a lot of cold weather and a lot of anomalous weather connected with that. Now, one of the things that you can do with that kind of a bend, which was very much evidenced in latter 83, when you had the very unseasonable cold weather breaking all the records everywhere, one of the things you can do with that is, of course, bring in cold across a lot of the United States and very far south indeed, so that southern cities were reporting some of the coldest weather they'd ever had. Many of them had records broken, and so did other cities across the United States. The other thing you can do, if you sustain that for a while and don't let it pop back up, you can begin to entrain moisture from well out in the Pacific and drag a flow of moisture in across the southern part of the United States. Now, they did that sort of thing again early this year. As a matter of fact, the first day of February, they moved a giant ice storm across the United States. And so February of 85, we had a very nice anomalous mixture of extremely cold weather drawn down from Canada, mixing with this giant stream of moisture drawn in from the Pacific right across the Southland, and so we had an ice storm. Here in Huntsville, Alabama, for example, in the surrounding area, about 60,000 homes were knocked out of power, and all the motels and hotels and everything were full while people were trying to make it through several days without power. Actually, I also went several days without power and can sympathize with people that's a bit difficult to do. But anyway, they gave us that nice ice storm. That was courtesy of the Hammer and Sickle Boys.
And then it went on up into the East Coast where they had record-breaking sub-zero weather that was extremely troublesome. And at last count, approximately how many deaths were endured this last winter that were weather-related?
I don't have an actual count for the whole winter, but it looks like it's been averaging over 100 people a year that you could say probably due to the change in weather. In other words, the number of deaths due to weather and weather-related effects has just about doubled. And so if you want to make a conservative estimate, you'd say this change in weather, this anomalous change, has accounted for up to, say, 500 deaths or so that we would not have had not the anomalies occurred.
But we're having to look at something, whether it's Mother Nature or man, putting a 90-degree turn in the jet stream and then turning it 90 degrees again. Just the ticket, just the thing necessary to create some very strange havoc weather. Is that a battle of the weather wars? Jenkins with me from Huntsville, Alabama, on our conference line is Thomas E. Bearden. And we are talking about the likelihood of being engaged in a weather war, an undeclared one. We're looking at some of the science that Tom has been explaining to you. Tom, when they developed these interference zones and we have these crossed scalar beams coming together, either extracting energy or creating energy in an area, are there some signatures that you can see, something that gives you a little more validity other than just theory?
Yes, indeed. Fortunately, the clouds react to the particular kind of pattern that's emerging up there. And so the clouds themselves will give you signatures of what kind of thing is going on. And some of these are very much different from any kind of natural thing that occurs in the clouds. For example, one of the patterns that occurs in the cloud, I've been calling a giant radial. What happens is a thin line of cloud forms an almost perfect circle, about two-thirds of a circle. And then outside that ring, our radials run straight away for about 15 miles or so, usually, in little straight lines. It looks just like a giant rising sun symbol, sort of, from World War II, hanging up there in the sky, in the clouds themselves. When the power is on, in other words, when the actual power is going on, the pattern is very clear. In other words, the lines are very sharp, they're thin, and the ring is a very nice ring. And that kind of a thing just doesn't occur in nature. Now, the moment they cut the power for that particular little goose that they did, so to speak, the inner ring will fill up with clouds, and so you'll have the whole inside part of it filled up. The outside rays then are now running from the filled-in cloud in the middle, and they get a little fatter, but they're still cloud rays. And so for some time before the upper winds chop that thing up and fatten it out and so forth and lose it, you can see a pattern that's still anomalous enough that you know it wasn't done by Mother Nature. And those kinds of signatures have occurred all over the United States. I've seen several of them myself. I photographed several of them. I flew over one. We were at 35,000 feet. It was about 5,000 feet below us, 400 miles from Memphis. They've been widely reported directly off the west coast there from Los Angeles and San Diego. And they've usually been associated with an area about the time that, say, 3 days to a week later, you get an anomalous weather change. Sometimes a weather change the meteorologist didn't even expect at all. It catches them by surprise. And so they are associated with the weather changes. Another pattern that you get is when they are first establishing the grid itself, not adjusting it. Oftentimes, the clouds themselves will form a grid. Under just the right conditions, you will get suddenly in the clouds above you a regular grid just like a checkerboard. I mean, it's like an artist went up there and drew it in the clouds. Now, clouds ruffle and fluffle a bit in nature, quite a bit, but they do not form absolutely geometric grids that cross each other that way. I've described that as looking exactly like a cross-plowed field. It's like you plow the field north to south, let's say, and then you turn around and you plow the same field again east to west in nice even rows. That's exactly what the sky looks like above you when this sort of thing is going on.
Do you have any pictures of that?
I have pictures of one of them after the power had been cut again and the grid was being chopped up, so it's not too good. But the one fellow named Bill Jenkins got a pretty good picture of one.
Yes, he did. And it's interesting to note what you said, Tom. I took those videotapes on July 29th at about 10:30 in the morning. The power point was above the Saugus Newhall area, but it was easily seen from my vantage point in the northern part of the San Fernando Valley. And the grid system, it looked to me like a series of Chiclets chewing gum lined up in a row. And those pictures will be available to our listeners in the next issue of Let's Talk magazine. The article I will be writing for it is The Weather War. And we will go over a lot of the information here. We will have pictures of the giant radials. There will be some of the things that Tom is talking about here explained with graphics for you. So I suggest that you look for the next issue of Let's Talk magazine. I didn't think I'd ever be able to see one of those, Tom, but there it was.
Well, it turns out that most of us don't do that much looking at the sky, and when we do, we sort of look in an almost hypnotized fashion. You know, there's the sky, the same sky we saw yesterday, so to speak. We don't really meticulously go around noticing the sky. It has to be remarkable. Something there has to be usually remarkable before we notice it in the clouds. But these particular signatures have been widely cited over the U.S., over various places in the U.S., everything from the East Coast to right on out to the West Coast, over the middle of the country and everything. In fact, on one of these programs, we had a gentleman call in who was a chicken farmer. And he reported that he had been seeing these things near his farm where he raised chickens, and every time one of those was in the sky, the chickens were very disturbed. And he was wondering if that was connected with that thing. And of course it is. The same kind of scalar emissions you get from prior to earthquakes, you get from the stresses in the rocks when an earthquake is building up. And so you get all kinds of animal disturbances because animals sense those things more than we do. We tend to just get a little bit irritable or something like that, whereas the animal reacts physically and gets panic-stricken. And so, yes, indeed, there are animal disturbances connected with them as well. But they've been seen throughout the U.S. That's one signature, the giant radial.
Well, I thought it was interesting what you said a minute ago, that within 48 hours after the appearance of this giant radial and this crosshatch effect in the sky, you can expect some changes in the weather. And the one that we videotaped was on July 29th. And 2 days later, California started burning with the worst fires that it ever had in history. Killer fires. We don't have the data yet to connect all of that. At this moment, it's simply a curiosity, right?
That's correct. We do know that there's been some evidence of the radials active in the area. We know that there's been some evidence of some of the little micro cracks and airquakes and so forth around there, too. It's a little bit early yet to say what fits what.
Well, I know that the phone lines are beginning to...
I would like to say one other thing, Bill.
Okay.
As far as controlling the weather, there are people here in the United States, for example, a few of them, who do indeed go out and do weather engineering. Now, a very good fellow that does that, repeatedly produces results, lives right there in California. His name is Trevor Constable.
Yes. So it is done.
It is done, and it can be done. And I think anybody that looks at his work is going to have to admit he produces what he says he produces.
But here we're looking more than doing something to get rain. It seems to be being used against us in an unusual way.
That's correct. Even the journal Science has pointed out that the weather in the last decade has been more anomalous than you would expect except once in about 1,200 years.
You ready to take on the callers?
We'll take some.
Okay. Let me give you the numbers in Los Angeles. All the numbers end in talk. Thomas E. Bearden and Bob is on the line. Bob, welcome aboard.
Hi there, Bill. Tom, it's an enjoyment every time you're on.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, I have a little difficulty hearing you through the phone.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's a little louder. That's as loud as I can get my phone.
Okay. What I want to do is take you through a whole series of little steps here. It's not very long. Tesla said, for instance, he could split the Earth with his extra low frequency standing waves. Of course, we don't know that could be so, and I think he found out later he couldn't quite, but it was an attempt. These low-frequency waves, which I believe he experimented quite a bit with in Colorado, we had a very high power requirement. The other thing we learned from Tesla was how to fix nitrogen from the air to make nitric acid and to make fertilizer. This is through the having a very high energy spark gap. In the 30s, we threw up in this country from the burning of coal enormous amounts of soft coal smoke all over the country. We did not have acid rain at that time. We were having only our gasoline fumes. When we look at this phenomenon of acid rain, which is widespread in not only in the United States and Canada, but also in Europe and the northern energy countries, we don't hear, or I haven't heard, of acid rain in Russia. So I have a one, but I also know that we are throwing enormous amounts of radio energy up in the air, and I wondered what all of this energy thing may have to do. That is, are we creating some of our own patterns, just like you said, through random choice, or are the Russians creating some of our acid rain? Are they adding to it? And where do they get the power to sustain these phenomena that you mentioned? Although I do recall an extremely anomalous southernward motion of the jet stream in World War II. That's a pretty involved set of questions, but I think you can follow me.
Okay, let me take a crack at it. It's a good set of questions, by the way. First of all, acid rain, I have no expertise at all. And I have to admit that straightforward. I do know it's a major concern. For example, the Black Forest in Germany, the very beautiful, world-renowned Black Forest, is slowly dying. It's strangling from acid rain. And many other places on the...
I've seen the pictures in National Geographic.
Yes, and you can see what a tragedy that is. And other places in our beautiful forest are suffering in the same way. But I really do not know at all what is causing the acid rain, and even the experts seem to disagree. They basically are trying to blame it on the emissions from the factories and so forth. But as far as I personally know, I don't believe they've really tied down the fundamental mechanism that's producing it. And I don't know what it is myself. As for the Tesla spinning the Earth, we found out that mass for scalar waves, when you establish a scalar resonance, mass can act just like charging a capacitor. In other words, it's an accumulator. If you continue charging unrestrained, the Earth or the mass will continue to absorb more and more and more of this energy stored in this peculiar form. And what Tesla was talking about, although he didn't make it quite that clear, if he were to produce a standing scalar resonance in the Earth and continue to pour energy in it, eventually the energy would build up so high that he could disrupt the Earth. And in fact, that could be done. He said he didn't know how long it would take, maybe 2 years or so. That technically is feasible by using scalar waves. Now, May Day of this year for the Soviet Union was a very special occasion. It was the 40th anniversary, you know, after the end of World War II. And so the 40th year of May Day was very special, and the celebrations lasted for several days this year. Just prior to May Day, they activated, according to measurements of Frank Golden, who's been measuring the scalar stuff they're putting in the Earth, they activated what appears to have been the entire scalar weapon systems in the Soviet Union. Now, one of the things, the Earth already has natural scalar resonances in it. And Frank can put those on the screen, and I've seen them. I've looked at the natural scalar resonances of the whole Earth. But a natural resonance wanders back and forth about some center frequency because the Earth is not a regular structure. However, ever since he's been measuring this, there have been two artificial resonances established in the Earth. They are rock solid, they do not vary, they do not change. And they are Soviet Union resonances established in the entire Earth on the Tesla principle.
Are you saying they are continuously there?
Yes, they have been since he's been measuring, since, say, 83. Now, they were 12 kilohertz apart, and one of the things that they could do with this kind of a tap in the Earth, they could use that difference to tap off ordinary energy. They could convert it into ordinary energy, and they could get enormous amounts of energy from such a tap. That would give them the energy to power enormous transmitters, indeed, to use for strategic weapons of this fashion. Now, what he noticed before May Day was a sudden activation of an enormous amount of those taps. For example, he counted some 27 of those sets of two frequency taps into the Earth that suddenly came on. And an enormous number of ordinary scalar wave transmissions, which would have been the command and control systems. So apparently, in and around the May Day celebrations this year, the Soviets activated the entire strategic scalar weapon system and rehearsed it and went through exercises with it, cut some things on and off and so forth. But for a while there, it was really, really quite alarming because of the large number of scalar transmitters that were on and the large number of weapon taps. For example, if you estimate that one of those taps could provide power for 4 to 6 weapons, then you see we're talking about something that can approach 100 weapons or so that would have been brought up online and exercise. Just, it would be something similar if we were to bring up all our missile men, for example, our missile man missiles, and go through exercises with them in some giant exercise. The Soviets actually had such a giant exercise, apparently, connected with the May Day celebrations this year. So we do know they have a large number of the systems. We know they have the taps in the earth. They can put them in there whenever they want to, and that they can power the weapons that way. Now, when they finish the exercise, they cut off all of the taps except the original pair and one additional pair. So there's, the last I knew, there were four of them sitting there now, still in oscillation and resonance throughout the earth.
Well, those taps must have to be very deep and very massive.
They go through the entire earth. And what they're doing with those things, they're tapping off from the molten core of the earth. Now, let's see, one other part of your question, the spark gap and so forth, I really am...
I was relating to this nitrogen output to electric or high energy frequencies in the atmosphere, creating nitrogen oxides, which in turn become, with moisture, become nitric acid.
Yes, indeed. I think that we get a lot of the nitrogen from the atmosphere anyway due to the electrical activity of storms and so forth.
Well, this was always there, and we didn't have acid rain before.
I don't know what causes the acid rain. By the way, if you ever find anybody that does know what causes it, I'd sure like to know. Because
well, I'm throwing it out for listeners. I've presented it to one authority who says, yes, it's a very interesting idea, and I can't tell you anything about it.
Oh.
All right, so that's kind of where we stand on that. But
no, I thank you.
Good questions, Bob. Appreciate them very much.
I thank you, Tom.
It's open mind. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, Thomas E. Bearden.
How we can get copies of Let's Talk?
Let's Talk is a magazine that you can subscribe to just by contacting the radio station. I think it's also going to be on the newsstands when the next issue is out and the last one. They're located, Valley Publishing is the publisher of it out in Granada Hills. You can call there.
Okay, I'd like to know from Tom where we can get copies of the energy releases that were taken by the satellites off of Bennett Island.
The best place is in Aviation Week. I don't have the reference right in front of me, but Aviation Week printed three photographs. I also have included the same three photographs in one of Novaya Zemlya, exhaust off of that, in the tape that we just made, the videotape that's available.
I'd like to know, why would the Soviets be testing these devices off Japan and South Africa if they wanted the weapon to be a secret weapon? It seems to me they would want to test it over their own uninhabited territory or else shoot the beams out in space and take measurements from there.
Well, of course, they may have done that, too.
But why would they be, you know, putting them either off of Japan or off of South Africa where other people could see them and perhaps take some form of measurements?
Same reason that they fire missiles into areas like that. They fire missiles into designated areas of the ocean. As a matter of fact...
Tom, could I get you to speak up? And Bob, or Jim,
yeah.
Could you kind of back away? We're getting kind of a little off balance there.
Oh, okay. How's this, Bill? I'm as close as I can get.
That's better. All right.
Okay. It's conventional to test weapons in various ocean areas of the world. For example, in that cold explosion off Japan, just a few days before that, the Soviets had very hastily announced a missile test to be conducted in an area not very far from there. So they do this quite often. And they fire missiles into areas and so forth. And nations of the world warn other nations when they're going to be testing in certain areas and warn them to stay out of there. That's very conventional.
Seems to me that for a weapon system like this, though, they'd want to test it over Siberia where nobody else could have their spy ships in the vicinity to be able to keep an eye on it.
Well, all I can tell you is they're testing it throughout the earth the same way... they don't hesitate to do that whenever they feel they need to, just like they've not hesitated to blast out of the air a whole series of airplanes, not just the Korean airliner.
Mm-hmm.
Just Defense Weekly, for example, not too long after the loss of that Korean airliner, printed a listing of the actual airplanes that have been shot down the same way by the Soviet Union. So it's not spectacular for them to do things that we think is not quite the way we would do it.
You mentioned grid adjustment a while back. Do they need physical observers in the area to be able to verify this adjustment?
That I don't know. They certainly have enough of them. The FBI has given up trying to track all the non-Soviet agents in the U.S. because there are more Soviet agents admitted by the FBI known in the United States than there are FBIs.
Do you happen to know of any U.S. spy satellite photos of these transmitters?
No, I know of none because I wouldn't have access to that information. Everything that I'm doing has come totally from open information.
Considering the power requirements of these transmitters, do you feel that they'd be able to place these on ships?
Yes, there's no problem with that. Of course, on this program, quite often, you've had some free energy discussions. Several devices now are working to produce energy out of the vacuum. I might point out that if you look at two electrons, the electromagnetic force between those two electrons is somewhere on the order of about 10 to the 38th times as strong as the gravitational force. Now, what does this mean? This means that if you could convert 100% of that electromagnetic force into the gravitational force, for every unit of electromagnetic force you had to begin with, you would get 10 to the 38th units of gravitational force. So if you can convert just a fraction of the electromagnetic energy into gravitational energy with the scalar electromagnetics, you can get local bending of space-time that is very appreciable, and therefore you can build free energy devices. It's absolutely within the present physics theory.
Would you happen to know of any sort of U.S. intelligence that would tell us of unusual ships that might have this sort of equipment on them?
Well, you understand, if I didn't know about it, I wouldn't talk about it.
Well, I thought that perhaps, you know, Jane's Military, the book that usually comes out, they usually have new weapon systems and such, or perhaps even speculate on some. I thought that maybe there was something out there for the general public to consume that I didn't know about.
There are very authoritative books put out by Jane's and others on Soviet weapons. Now, one of the problems you have here, and that's a good question, by the way, one of the problems you have is the transmitter itself has now become the key weapon. But you see, in our lexicon in the West, we do not address that kind of a weapon at all. And so we never identify any kind of weapon officially as being that. It's only recently that in various places throughout the military here in the U.S., people are finally beginning to get somewhat seriously interested in what we're talking about here. They're now beginning to take it seriously, and they're not stopping at it anymore. I'm not saying they believe everything I'm saying. I'm just saying they're not taking it seriously.
Okay, Jim, does that help you? We got a lot of calls here. Yeah, very good group of questions, and we appreciate those.
Well, I'd like to ask one more, if that's okay.
Make it quick.
Okay, since these devices can extract energy as well as place it into an area, have any of our power companies been noticing unusual drain-off? Because it seems to me that if the Soviets could extract it, that they would use it instead of having to build their own hydroelectric facilities or something like that.
Well, it's a lot easier to do it with other ways than have to extract it from a distance and then try to use it, because when you extract it, it's coming back as something you've got to get rid of, or it's right in your transmitter and it's going to bother you. So as far as I know, they're not using that kind of means for any kind of power source. They may be involved, and I say maybe because I've not had time to try to do any analysis on it. They may be involved in a few of the anomalous power outages we've had in the United States and Canada as well.
Thank you very much. It's been awfully nice speaking with you.
Thank you, Jim.
Bye. Jim, good questions. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, Tom Bearden. Weather, war, and we're talking to Craig way up in Northern California. Welcome aboard.
Hi, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Craig.
We've had a number of excellent conversations in the past. I've always been fascinated by what you have to say. I find a good deal of what you had to say tonight to be plausible. I'm going to subject you to some more serious questions tonight. Let me put it this way. When you're talking about a subject as sensitive as U.S.-Soviet relations, military and otherwise, something that can't be discussed too carefully, I think you understand what I mean by that.
I've spent quite a few years in that kind of business.
Right. Let's see. First, well, the last two questioners have kind of started off some of the lines of questions I had in mind. First of all, could you give me a rough ballpark figure of the amount of energy that would be required to divert the jet stream?
Offhand, I couldn't without, you know, taking time out to actually do some calculations. I have not done those.
You'd have to produce, you know, some large high-pressure areas, and you'd have to produce some large lows. And it wouldn't be just energy. You'd have to have power, because you'd have to keep extracting energy from the low to keep it low. And you'd have to keep adding energy to the high to keep it high.
Uh-huh.
So it's a matter of so much power, you see.
Well, are you saying that you have done the calculations in the past?
No, I have not.
Well, I would think that's a very basic requirement if we're going to assert that anybody on the planet has the capability to do that.
Tell you what, why don't you make the calculation and send them to me?
Well, I'm asking you, because
well,
you're making
you.
The...
See, I'm going to put the onus right back on you. It's your idea. You make the calculation.
Okay, I'll leave that one for the moment. Let's see. Okay, you were discussing a related subject. One of the callers was talking about the possibility of using the Earth's resonances to create a very serious disturbance of the entire planet. And again, has anybody gone through the energy calculations and power calculations for such a thing?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about a diode or a triode. For example, if you're talking about the use of something in a diode fashion, you've got to put all the energy in, you're going to get used in the system. But if you're talking about using it in the triode fashion, where you just put the signal in, which gates some other flow of energy, then you're not talking about the same kind of energy requirements. And there are ways to do it in the Earth, apparently, where you can use a sort of a triode effect. In other words, you can gate a series of systems that already go on in the Earth. If you do that, it doesn't take you putting in all the energy to get the energy acting in the Earth. In other words, you can draw energy from the molten core of the Earth, and it can furnish the energy you're using.
Right.
You've just got to gate it.
Right, I understand. Would there be anything analogous to that, then, in terms of diverting something like the jet stream?
No, as far as I know, and I understand there may be other mechanisms that I do not know about. But as far as I know, the mechanism they seem to be using is the production of high-pressure areas by adding energy throughout a zone, and the production of low-pressure areas by withdrawing energy from that zone. Now, I will say this. Working with a scientist there in California, and I will not name the scientist, he has done the little cold explosion type of thing, for example, with scalar beams over a little dish of water in the lab. Now, we're just using milliwatts of power, you understand. We don't have enormous transmitters cranked up.
Right.
He was using milliwatts of power and created a little cold explosion over a dish of water. And when that happens, you have it drawn up from the water, and they form a little cloud. And because it's a low pressure area there, the rushing air rushing in from all around it moves it up and forms a little mushroom. It does form a little mushroom cloud, just like the thing off Japan. And so, you know, the basic mechanism we're talking about has been done in the laboratory.
Well, I guess there's a question as to whether that would scale up in a proportional...
The mechanism itself is not scale-dependent at all. You know, it's the basic physical mechanism. It's the use of the beams to produce a certain kind of energy production or energy extraction. That has nothing to do with scale.
What about the energy requirements for the initial production of the scalar energy in the Soviet Union?
Since I don't know how much they produce, you know, I don't know what the energy requirements would be or exactly what kind of things they're using for energy. Now, there are papers from the Soviet Union which show that they certainly have used entire power systems and entire power plants to drive a transmitter. And they've reported, even with conventional transmitters, enormous crops and enormous voltages and penetrating through the entire crust of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. I guess then you haven't made any kind of ballpark estimate of what they're actually doing, what they're putting into this in terms of their energy system.
No, it would be difficult to do without knowing, number one, how many they have, number two, having a better system of measurement. Here in the West, in this whole area, we're still very primitive. Even the few people who are doing some work in the scalar electromagnetics, it's still very primitive. We're back where the ordinary electromagnetics was when they were rubbing glass rods with cat fur.
So we've got a lot of work to do. One of the reasons for going into this area is because, number one, it is a threat to us. Number two, the only way we're ever going to catch up is we've got to get all the universities turned on.
And that's what we're all about here, is to turn on the universities, turn on the genius of the American people. Craig, that brings us to the end of hour two of Open Mind tonight. Thank you very much for the question.
Hold on?
Yeah, you want to hold on? Okay. We're going to take a break.
Thank you.
We're talking to Tom Bearden tonight on Open Mind, and we're talking about something that needs your attention, the weather war. Come on in. We have another hour to go. Welcome to Hour 3 tonight of Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins, and I hope you are as spellbound as I have been. Through the course of this evening, our guest speaking to us on our conference line from Huntsville, Alabama, a member of the Association of Distinguished American Sciences, Mr. Thomas E. Bearden. And we are talking about what appears to be, perhaps, an undeclared weather war that is being waged against us. We've heard some of the science, we've seen the signatures of the science, we've seen what they have been doing to us. Tom, you mentioned a little while ago that there was a tape, a videotape, in which you had explained a lot of this and where people themselves can see the photographs. Many of those photographs in your tape will be printed in Let's Talk magazine in the upcoming article about the weather war that I will have in there. Is that tape available to the general public?
Yes, it is. And let me talk about that just a moment. This is a one-hour tape. It's available in either VHS or Beta. It's $40 postpaid. And we'll send it right out. I'll give the address, and I'll tell you what's in the tape. The address is Post Office Box 1472, Huntsville, Alabama, 35807. Post Office Box 1472, Huntsville, Alabama, 35807. Now, the first part of the tape goes briefly through the actual physics involved, the Kaluza-Klein geometry that's involved. And I show with some analogies exactly how you can turn the electromagnetic energy into gravitational field energy and vice versa. Then, using the scalar beams, we show you how that can be intersected over the U.S. and then show pictures of some of the giant radials that we've seen and photographed. And we show pictures of the exhausts on Bennett Island taken by U.S. weather satellites. We show some three or so of those. We show a picture of one of the exhausts on Novaya Zemlya that's also going on in the Soviet Union. And so we go into some other anomalous phenomena that are connected with that grid, such as mysterious failures of engines and airliners and so forth, and such as mysterious power failures in San Diego connected with chaff drops. And we give you the mechanisms by which all of that occurs. And so the tape itself is a rather complete explanation of exactly how the Soviet Union is doing weather warfare, at least as far as our understanding of it is at the present time.
Well, it's a riveting tape. I certainly value my copy.
Well, one of the things we want to add to the tape as soon as we can, as soon as we can get some more studio time, is we want to add on, since we've gotten Bill's permission, a little bitty trailer showing the pictures that he took of the grid up in the sky there in Los Angeles.
Well, you're certainly welcome to put it in there. And I'm delighted that you feel that strongly about them, that you want to include that in a rather scientific thing.
Well, you see, one of the things we want to do is urge everybody out there who sees these patterns to please try to get a photograph and contact either Bill Jenkins or myself and let us know what you've got and what it looks like and where it was, because then we can connect that to the actual weather changes that are occurring. We can associate them and see if they correlate.
So we look for this hub and spoke, or this rising sun effect laying horizontal in the sky, this crosshatch perfect squares being formed in the cloud formations. When you see anything like that, clouds streaming into a central point as if they're all vectoring into one point in the crosshatch formation, snap a picture. You have a videotape machine, take tape, send it to me when you get it, or to Tom.
And make sure you write down the date, the time, you know, the weather conditions, all the things like that. They're exactly what it is that you're seeing when you see that.
Because it is a very important piece of a puzzlement right
now. And by the way, if the listener doesn't have a camera when he sees one of these, and I've had that experience, whip out a piece of paper and make as good a sketch as you can. That's also very worthwhile because it does show what you're seeing at that particular time and where it is.
All right, let's go to our callers now. I think we have Rex standing by. Rex, welcome aboard.
Thank you very much. One of the first questions I'd like to ask, Tom, is last time he was on the program, he told us that there wasn't a whole lot of awareness with the Defense Department on this. What I'd like to ask is, has this brought up quite a bit more awareness? And if it has, what does the government plan on doing for countermeasuring these?
Oh, boy. Of course, you understand, I can't speak for the government at all.
I'm in the military, too, but yeah. I can understand, you know, what you can put out in public and what you can't.
Okay, since you've dealt with the bureaucracy that we all have to deal with, and I'm not saying that necessarily in a derogatory sense, that's the nature of any large organization.
Mm-hmm.
Since we have such a bureaucracy that we have to deal with, you understand that the only way to get anything done anymore is you have to bypass all the stuff going up the middle. And you have to come in at a fairly high level before you can find anybody who's got power enough to do anything. Otherwise, it just stays buried up in committees and people who don't believe anything new will ever come along anyway. So what you have to do is generate some way to climb the ladder around where all the blocks are. And so one of the ways you do that is with a series of articles that do not get censored, that do go ahead and carry out the stuff that's in the open literature and can be seen in the sky and photographed. And you put all that together and you simply put it out there so that anybody can read it. After a while, people begin to pick it up. Of course, judiciously, inside the whole bureaucracy, there's always a hidden organization in any organization. And so what happens is people start to circulate the material and say, here, what do you think of this? And gradually, the material works its way up to a higher level. Well, now, those fellows have access to a lot more sensitive information than I do. And so if there's some validity in what we're saying, they're going to be comparing it to a much wider range of information than anything I've looked at. And so at some point, if there's some substance to it, then they're going to start to get interested. And that's one way of sort of feeding the system and say, hey, guys, you know, go look in this area and see what you find. You sort of stimulate them which way to go, and they go look. And many times when they do that, they find something they have been overlooking. Now, this particular case, the scalar electromagnetics and the weapons from that, is very difficult. The reason is, suppose you worked, for example, in an intelligence agency, and you're responsible for spending American taxpayers' money. You're not going to spend that on just everything that comes down the pipe on any kind of wild idea comes along.
You're going to
look at that very carefully. Okay, here comes an idea you've never heard of before in your life. So where do you turn to see if there's any substance to that? You turn to the orthodox scientific community. And what are they going to tell you? They're going to tell you, we've never heard of anything like that. It's not in our textbooks. That's the problem. And those guys do very well, do very good at the things they know, or the things that our scientists know about. The problem in this area has been it deals with an area that we don't know about, and our scientists don't. And that's why it's been necessary to go open with this stuff and to write papers and put out all the incidents that I can gather and collate together, and why I've been doing this sort of thing for really quite a few years indeed.
Tom, do you know enough about it to where if the government just happen to give you an open way to do something, what would you suggest we do on something like this? What would be your plan of action?
Well, there are certain people in the United States, a few of them, who are already working in elementary scalar technology. For example, it is possible to build a free energy device, and several of them have been built. The Bedini device, Jim Watson has built several devices, and there are several other inventors right now who have working model free energy devices and are hidden down the road trying to get to market. Good Lord willing, we're going to see one or more of those devices on the market, hopefully, in less than a year. The other thing should be done for countermeasures. The Soviet Union is, their leaders are not fools, nor are they crazy. They are not insane, and they simply won't blow up the world. So what we need to do is counter and check and build defenses in the area. They're counters to these weapons just like they're counters to any weapon. Once we do that, it is possible to get an agreement with the Russians in this area. I believe it is possible. The reason I believe that is they tried to get an agreement with us in it in the first place, in 1975. For example, in 1975, Brezhnev made a major speech to the leaders of the Communist Party and the leaders of the Soviet Union, pointing out that they needed one other kind of agreement that they did not have, and it was to ban the development of new weapons far more frightful than the nuclear weapons and missiles and so forth. Very shortly thereafter, he pounded all over a group of visiting senators with the same message. We've got to negotiate this additional agreement. We've got to do it. Shortly thereafter, Polarov, the secretary of the party, dumped all over a bunch of visiting congressmen. The same message. We must negotiate this other agreement. Then shortly thereafter, Gromyko actually carried a draft agreement to the United Nations and introduced it and urged the nations of the world to sign it. And Article 1 of that agreement essentially stated that, hey guys, once we start negotiating, we'll negotiate to turn the weapons we're talking about. We were so locked in on nukes and bombers and submarines and missiles and so forth that we simply did not know what the Soviet Union was talking about at all. And I think in 1975 we missed an opportunity to get an agreement to ban the kinds of weapons we're talking about. And I think such an agreement can still be gotten once we develop defenses and once, it's negotiating from equals.
I have two very short follow-up questions, Tom. One of them is a friend of mine and myself, we work with a machine which picks up satellite pictures, weather pictures. Is there any way that I can see a difference in what it's doing to the weather as far as what it's showing out on our printout?
Well, I went through a whole exercise, spent quite a little chunk of my change, trying to take some of the satellite photos from the stationary satellites out there on a given area at a given day when I knew that giant radios had been sighted. In fact, I'd seen them. And so we zeroed in on the exact times, the coverage during the time when those radios were in the sky. The problem was those long-distance satellites were sitting out there about 22,000 miles or so. And believe it or not, from that picture, you can see across the whole United States and you can get the nice flow of the clouds and all that. But you can't see a 15-mile phenomenon. You can't pick it out of the ordinary clouds. We even blew that thing up as big as we could get them to blow it up. We had them do it and paid to do it. And we still couldn't pick out the regulars on the cloud, even though we'd seen them from the ground. And, you know, multiple witnesses, everything else. So it proved to be impossible to get them from that series of photos, even though we tried very hard. Now, if someone happens to have some lower level shots on the same day, I don't know of any right over the U.S. Our weather satellites, however, do circle the globe, I believe, twice a day is what they're doing. The two of them are still up there. If we could get something down lower where a 20-mile cloud pattern would show clearly, that would be very useful indeed, because then we could get a good satellite photo of one of these giant radios, and that's what we need.
Tom, what would happen if we produced the same beams that they're sending over here and crossed them with theirs? What would that produce?
Everywhere they cross, you'll get the interference pattern, and depending on the relationship of the potentials, you can either get extraction of energy or you can get production of energy. In other words, what you're suggesting is very interesting. One of the things you could do, and I'll give you this one, this is a counter to the weapon. One of the things you could do is if you actually could have the instrumentation and measured all the stuff they had on there scale-wise so that you could rig the same signals, you could produce the same signals on the same kind of carrier, put it right back on them so that it interferes in the energy dump mode. In other words, all of a sudden they would be getting energy back in their transmitters and boom, off goes the transmitter. It'd be possible to actually sit here and blow out their transmitters by doing that. So that would be one kind of counter you could do, and in other words, teach them a lesson. Say, look, fellas, we don't want this stuff messing up our weather, or else we'd be able to do something to you the same way. If you could do that, then what you would see very shortly is they would quit messing up the weather over our heads. Right now, there's no such counter at all going on. They're not losing their transmitters, and so they don't have to worry about that effect. They can do what they will because we don't have such a device. I will point out to you that the ham radio operators who suffered for a long time because of the woodpecker signals interfering with our communications once got together and all recorded the woodpecker. And then they all turned their tape recorders on and their transmitters on and beamed that thing right back at the Soviet Union. And very rapidly, the woodpecker signals all began to change frequency. Boy, they got out of there. So, yeah, they're sensitive to it, and yeah, you can count it from here. There are counters to any kind of a weapon, including this stuff.
Does that help you, Rex?
Yes, it does. I would like to ask Tom if he has a newsletter that we can get follow-up information about this.
Well, at the present time, I don't. I publish articles usually dealing with energy in the newsletter from the American Association of Gravity Field Energy. And it's the same place here, Huntsville, Alabama. The P.O. box for it is 7004. It has a little newsletter that carries quite a few of my articles dealing with energy, which I discuss the physics of this stuff.
Okay. Thank you.
Other than that, it's the Bill Jenkins Show, and it's also a whole series of papers that I've written that are published by the Tesla Book Company right there in Millbrae, California. Their zip is 94030, and their street address is 1580 Magnolia. They have a whole series of publications dealing with these particular weapons and so forth. And I have some others ready to be published, almost ready, that I just haven't finished yet.
Thank you very much, Tom.
All right, Rex, thank you for the good questions. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me tonight, Thomas E. Bearden is set. And if you'd like to go, I wish you'd send me just a card with your name, address, and just say London trip on it. And we'll get that off to Chucky Travel, part of the KABC Travel Club. They'll send you all of the information about it. We're going to spend the last week of October in London. We'll go to Stonehenge. We'll go to a number of the castles that have spirit manifestations there. We'll have banquets in some of the great castle halls, in fact. We'll spend Halloween night on the royal vessel Barracuda, going up and down the Thames underneath London Bridge in the Tower of London. And we'll go to Bath and see the great baths there. It's going to be quite a fun time. And if you'd like to go, we'd like to have all of you go with us that possibly can. Just send your name and address to me here at KABC, say London trip, and the travel club will be contacting you as to what all of that is all about. And we'll have a good time. All right, let's get on with the weather war questions. Maurice, you're on with us.
Yes, I'd like to ask Tom if these scalar beams are traceable. Can we trace them back to their source exactly?
Well, with the proper equipment, they are traceable. The problem is that normal detectors do not see the scalar beams at all. The reason is they don't move electrons in their normal fashion. So most all of our detectors and detector systems are based on eventually on moving electrons. And this doesn't move electrons. This thing moves the protons and the neutrons. It shakes them. But it doesn't actually move conduction electrons down a wire or something like that. And so the normal instruments do not see the scalar waves at all. But it's possible, of course, to build instruments that do. And several people have built such instruments. For example, the one I was referring to a moment ago was some very special instrumentation that Frank Golden has worked out. That's a fairly expensive thing. The instrument's about $14,000 or $15,000. But he can put the signals and the spectrum and everything else right there on the oscilloscope. It's a very beautiful instrument. The measurements are done inside a Faraday cage. So instruments can be developed, and you can measure the things. But right now, the orthodox scientific community does not have the instruments and is not measuring what's coming out of the Soviet Union scalar-wise.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know, and it seems like that would be a thing to work on. Thank you very much.
All right, Maurice, appreciate that call. It's Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, Tom Bearden. I'm Bill Jenkins. Open Mind is the name of this program, and with me is Thomas E. Bearden. We're talking about the weather war, and we have Hugh on the line. Hugh, welcome aboard.
Hello, Bill. Tom, I have a question for you that goes back to 1974. In February of 1974, there was one of our satellites picked up a tremendous amount of radioactivity and electromagnetic disturbances in the area of the Kola Peninsula in the Soviet Union. Did that have anything to do with this?
Hugh, I'm sorry, I simply don't know. I have not picked that up, nor have I investigated it.
Okay. This whole thing occurred in February, and there was a British trawler by the name of Gaul that disappeared at that time. And there's been speculation that it had something to do with particle beam experimentation or possibly weather modification.
Well, they certainly have done particle beam experiments, for example. And they certainly, in my opinion, have done weather modification. We will admit, even the orthodox people will admit, they've done an awful lot of weather modification experiments with conventional stuff. You know, everything from rockets fired up to try to knock the hail out of clouds and protect the crops to seeding with dry ice and all kinds of things. That's an interesting thing because the Russians report that they've achieved far better than 90% controlled hail, and certainly we've never been able to do anything like that with the kinds of things we know about.
Right. Okay, follow-on question then.
By the way, if you have a clipping or anything, or could Xerox a copy of any of the material you have on that February
74? I have pounds of it. No, I've been working on this this doll thing for about 5 years now.
Yeah.
And it's an intriguing situation.
Hey, it's a piece of the puzzle. Want to make some copies and send it along to either me or to Tom, and I'll make sure Tom gets them.
Okay, if someone could give me the address, Bill, I sure will, but I have a follow-on question, if I might.
All right.
A lot of speculation, Tom, on El Nino and the possibility that El Nino is a result of weather modification efforts or is being used in weather modification efforts by the Soviets. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. I can give you an opinion. I understand I'm going to accent the word opinion because, again, I've not had time to really do this one justice. I do know that the El Nino that occurred during a particular time we're talking about here, 82-83 time frame, was very anomalous indeed. It was early. It was far more drastic than we normally have. It caused weather upsets widespread throughout the Earth. There was the heaviest rain and flood in some 50 years or so, or half a century in Ecuador, North Peru, and so forth. There was very heavy rain in California, states like Louisiana, down in Cuba, and yet there was crippling drought in other areas. It really upset the weather patterns around the Earth. And the actual effects that it caused is quite well documented in the ordinary literature. Now, from a scalar viewpoint, what you may have had, and I say may have had because I don't know it was involved in this, what you may have had was a little bit of verging and a little bit of additional energy warming done by the Soviet Union to urge that thing along and make it anomalous. They certainly have the capability of doing that. I'm not saying that I can prove they did it. I just say they have the capability and may have done so. It was a very anomalous El Nino indeed. It did cause a lot of damage.
Well, I was back in Kansas during that time frame, and some of the most horrendous rainstorms in the spring, followed by tremendous droughts in the summer, and then most bitter cold weather in the history of the area in the wintertime. And it all sort of tied in with this weird activity of El Nino.
Well, see, it's exactly the kind of thing the Soviets would do in experimenting.
Right.
The way their mind works is they look at an area, they pick out all the major variables, and they say, okay, let's find out what happens if we make a little delta or a little change here in this variable. And certainly everybody knows that the El Nino causes drastic, weather changes in the Earth. So one of the things they would want to know, just how much additional change do we get if we goose El Nino a little bit.
Right.
And certainly they have the capability. At this point, I really can't say they did or didn't.
Okay. Bill, if you'll have somebody come on, I'll get your address and send you that material on Gaul and what happened in the Kola Peninsula.
I certainly appreciate it.
Okay.
It's very easy. Just 3321 South La Cienega Boulevard.
La Cienega.
Right. 90016.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Open Mind tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins. And it's Thomas E. Bearden's night, and we'll be back to Tom just a little.
Hi, Bill, Mr. Bearden.
How you doing?
Pretty good. While in Florida rather recently, towards the end of May, I was on a vacation down there, and I believe it was around over Sarasota. I wish I could be more certain, but you were talking about those spoke-shaped clouds.
Yes.
And it was, I believe it was around May, it would have been around May 25th. A large one over the Sarasota area, I believe it was.
Okay.
And, but you were talking, and in that area, I was thinking about what you were saying about this energy drain phenomenon where the two lines meet. And wouldn't that be particularly dangerous over, significant over the Gulf because of the Gulf Stream? Wouldn't it could possibly cause it cooler weather along the entire length of the Gulf Stream?
Yes, there are other effects that you can do in the weather besides just make highs and make lows. Of course, things like tampering with El Nino or any other normal mechanism that changes weather or affects the weather, tampering with that, of course, would tamper with the weather. So yes, you could tamper with anything that does induce weather changes and tamper with the weather.
I see. So they're causing a chain reaction.
Yes.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
But
okay,
you saw the giant radial over Sarasota, Florida?
Yes, I believe it was over Sarasota when I soon after I got there, and it would be around
the 25th.
Somewhere around the end of May, yes, around the 25th maybe of May. I believe it was, yes.
Okay, well, I've written that down, Joe, and I appreciate the information.
Oh, and incidentally, that would be shortly after they had those fires down there. So this would be something after the fact rather than before, but that might be significant.
Right.
It's a piece of the puzzle. Appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Joe.
Okay.
All right. Edson, you're on.
Good evening, Mr. Jenkins and Colonel Bearden. How are you this evening?
Fine. How are you doing?
Okay. Well, I have several questions here, but I'll try to keep them short. First, I've done a lot of work and research at Tesla, as I've mentioned before. And one of the interesting things is that in the Soviet Union, Tesla was really a hero. Last year, July the 12th, 1984, Radio Moscow on their technical show, to be honest, at my suggestion, ran a tribute to Tesla. And I have tapes, and if you or Mr. or Colonel Bearden would like the tapes, I'll send you a copy.
I appreciate it.
Okay. Now, what I want to ask is, when the weather war started, there was a high incidence. I think it was the highest period of sunspot activity. And I'm wondering if there's a relationship between that and the start of the weather warfare against the U.S. Also, is the tachyon effect or whatever connected with the scalar waves? And have you heard of a book, Space Wars, Space Weapons, Space War, by John W. McVeigh, Stein and Day, 1979? He mentions Tesla's work, and also his contention is that if an alien space attack by alien space creatures was launched against this planet, they would probably use something like you're talking about. And let's see, also, I know that you've written on psychotronic warfare, Soviet psychotronic warfare. I know the Soviets are extremely interested in heliobiology, that is, the relationship of sunspots and play conditions on the Earth. And since we've had such incidents of strange diseases hitting the civilization lately, I believe Legionnaire's disease, you wrote about that a few years ago, and the relationship between that and psychotronic warfare. And one final question, not taking up too much time. On the radio clouds. Interestingly enough, there was a report about 3 or 4 years ago that terrible symbol of horror and terror in the modern world, the Fleischmann, the swastika, there's some contention by two research scientists that that was caused by clouds being bent by the Earth's magnetic field in certain anomalous areas. There's magnetic field forces that don't always jive in certain parts of the world, and primitive society saw this and they attributed it to the gods. So, those are my questions.
Well, you've done a lot of homework.
Thank you.
Oh boy, let's see, where do we start? Indeed, in the Soviet Union, Tesla is well known. Far more than we've done as far as what's actually there in the scientific literature. After World War II, for example, the Soviets set up large agencies, large organizations. For example, one of them is staffed with something like 2,000 PhDs. And their job is to digest the literature of the West, the scientific literature. And they bought all the journals, everything that could be bought, copies gotten, loaded it on boats, carried it to the Soviet Union, and they went through and digested the whole thing. There's never been such an effort as that in the West. Not at all. Not when you actually sit down and just methodically chew through all the literature. The literature in the West is really very rich in effects and things that have been pointed out in obscure papers that nobody's ever done anything at all about. We're in such a rush to publish or perish that it's always get on with something else. And in the West, it seems to be that anything revolutionary takes us about 50 years to drag out of there and start doing something about it.
Mm.
The Soviet Union took to heart, and in some of my papers I give quotes from some of the Soviet books on military doctrine, they took to heart the U.S. development of the atomic bomb. in secret, and then the sudden use of this against an enemy by total surprise. And they decided that was a fundamental mechanism for modern war, and they state this kind of thing in some of their military books. And so they've done that to a high art. They actually look at science as being the main thing that's going to feed the new weapons, and they have actively looked for the new atomic bombs in the new areas. And they've been successful. They've scarfed up everything that's in the literature and digested it and took it from there. So also with the fantastic work of Dr. T.H. Moray, who had built free energy devices, and by the way, the devices could do some things besides free energy, before World War II, the Soviet Union did obtain the plans of how that device was built, and they got that shortly before World War II. So putting all that stuff together, they have actually made a science of raising or going after obscure areas of science that hold great promise if they can be developed, and putting the resources of the state behind them to see if they can't do that.
Mm.
Now, we do that, too, to a certain degree, but certainly not anything at all like the Soviet Union does it. As far as the space weapons and all of that, I'm not familiar with the particular book that you mentioned. Sunspot activity, yes, the Soviet Union, again, has had a great effort and done particularly some excellent mathematical work in correlating all kinds of phenomena. Diseases with sunspot activity, magnetic field changes, gravitational changes, all sorts of cycles and rhythms and so forth in nature. And they probably have done far more of that work than anybody else in the world. And a little bit of it they've published, but certainly they've looked at the effects of everything against everything else and seeing how the correlations, how they do or do not correlate. It is a fact in their papers in this country pointing out there are correlations to be gained between things like sunspot and spread of disease and other natural rhythms with the spread of disease. So that is, you know, at least recognized in our literature, but not to the extent that the Soviets have studied it.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the swastika, I really don't know the background of the, how it was the people there in Germany, Hitler and so forth, the Nazi party hit upon the swastika.
Mm-hmm. Could you mention the effect, I talked to you before on another radio show last week about the use of Tesla's death ray in Afghanistan?
Yes, what apparently happens, there's some incidents there that are very strange. The Soviets are using Afghanistan as a testing ground. For example, that's not really the regular Soviet army fighting there. That's what we would call a ready reserve. And what they're really doing is testing their training and the state of training and the functioning of the equipment and so forth. Because there's a large number of troops, really millions, that they intend to be able to activate very quickly in full units so that they can go from the present size of the armed forces to a huge army very quickly indeed. And they're testing out the state of training and everything of those troops. One of the things that happens, they're using gas, for example, against the rebels. Now, they're using mustard gas and nerve gas and some other gases, and gas kills people. But it takes a while, even for nerve gas, to kill folks. They kick a while. If you've ever seen an animal killed with nerve gas, the animal goes into violent convulsions, and it takes at least a few seconds, you know, like half a minute or so, to die. And the same for a human being. And so some of the people die with those kinds of symptoms. But some of them die with a special kind of symptom. They die as if their entire nervous system suddenly quit working. Not another nerve impulse was fired anywhere in the brain or the body. The body simply collapses instantly like a limp dish rag wherever it was when it's hit with that one. Now, they always associate that, apparently, with the Hind helicopters. When the helicopter comes in and fires gas rockets, apparently it lets go something which causes this kind of death also when they test it. They always test it, apparently, with the gas, so that we'll think it's some kind of gas. But apparently it is a tactical scalar weapon, because if your nervous system gets hit with a sudden violent pulse of scalar weapons or even a continuous beam, that's exactly the symptoms that happen when you get enough of it in the dose. You get instant death everywhere in the body all at once. And there's never another nerve signal that goes anywhere. The entire nervous system extinguishes instantly. Now, the other effect that happens when you do that to a body, very strange things happen to the body. For one thing, it doesn't decay very fast at all. And there's at least one recorded instance in a paper in Philadelphia where the guerrillas had been gone from a village, forced out of the village, and the Soviets came in and killed everybody left in the village. But they killed them with this kind of weapon. And over a month later, when the rebels got back, none of the bodies had decayed. They were still laying exactly where they had fallen, and not one of them had decayed. And so they were able to bury them and so forth exactly as they were, without any decay or anything like that. So there are some anomalies that indicate they have used at least close-range tactical scalar weapons against the Afghans and tested them out. And that was the Soviet high-end helicopters doing that.
All right, Edson, so you see what you got going there?
Okay, thank you very much.
All right.
All right, goody.
Thank you very much, Tom, for that. The use of the tactical weapons also is something that just needs to be brought to the attention of everybody. You're on Open Mind tonight with Thomas E. Durden. I'm Bill Jenkins. One more call here. Brian, you're on. Can make it as quick as you can.
Sure. I was speaking to a friend of mine tonight who works in the defense industry, and he asked me a question I couldn't answer. He said, if the Soviet Union does indeed have these scalar weapons, why have they been in such a mad scramble to steal our military technology in recent years?
The simple reason is they go at all corners of the board, all across the board. They want to get, for example, the computer technology we have because they're well behind us in that.
Mm.
They are not as far along in the chip technology as we are. They want to get that, particularly the LSI and so forth.
I see.
Anything at all that will further their aims or their effort, they go after. So they go after it right across the board.
Including missile technology?
Including missile technology, anything else they can get their hands on. The other thing is they want to know exactly where we are, too.
Oh. Yeah, that would make sense.
So now you have the question answered for you, friend.
I sure do.
It's wasn't a bad question. But
no, that's a good question because, you know, you do see them going after everything. For example, a few years back they got a hold of precision machines to make ball bearings and thereby increase the accuracy of their ICBMs, and that's bad when they do that.
Okay, Brian, does that help you?
Yes, it does, Bill.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Pass that along to your friend, and we've just passed out of time here on Open Mind. Tom Bearden, thank you again for a really informative night. Fascinating.
My pleasure, Bill.
And the pictures that Tom talked about will be in an upcoming article of mine in Let's Talk magazine. You'll see a lot of it. We'll go over some of it again about the weather war. Next week, we'll be talking about the Kabbalah from one of the world's leading experts about it, and there are some strange and amazing stories to be told. We'll do it next Saturday night on Open Mind.
Happy celebration 25!